Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. This week on Ring of Fire Radio, Lizzie Price from Accountable.us will join us to discuss a new report detailing how publicly traded companies use PPP money to enrich their shareholders. Heather Digby-Parton will help me recap the week's biggest news stories. And if you're listening to our free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member and a supporter of Ring of Fire over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby-Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we should be clear. We are recording this a little bit on the early side this week. It's Thursday evening. Tonight, we have a very odd situation. And frankly, I don't recall anything like this in my entire adult life. And since, knowing the length of the history of television, I think that it's safe to say that nothing like this has ever happened before, where we had a situation where Donald Trump dropped out of the debate because it was made a remote debate as a function of a huge swath of the White House crew having caught COVID, and Joe Biden saying, hey, they lied last time about getting tested. Maybe this should not be live, but it wasn't ultimately his choice. It was the debate organization choice. And so, but Joe Biden said, I'll do the remote town hall. If Trump shows up, then great. And Trump said, I'm not showing up. And instead, I guess it was just a day ago almost, NBC says, we'll give Trump time in that exact same hour. And this is a really stunning, I mean, NBC apparently said that it's a function of fairness. I think this is a stunning disservice to the American public. I mean, you want to do it an hour before or an hour after? You want to do it the next night? Seems more than legitimate, seems welcome, frankly. But to do it at the same time, I mean, it just seems utterly bizarre to me. And I imagine that Donald Trump tomorrow is going to be touting that he got better ratings, which I would, you know, on some level, the weird part about it is that's Joe Biden's strategy, right? Make this about Donald Trump. And presumably, Donald Trump is not only going to have his supporters watching, but a lot of people who are going to, you know, hope that they see a train wreck. And that's his mystique. What's your sense of that? And then we can just move on to, you know, the other amazing things that happened this week.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you about the debate. Two town halls head-to-head being a disservice to the American people. Really, there was absolutely no reason for NBC to agree to that other than the ratings, which is obviously what motivated them. I'm sure that's what Donald Trump wanted, but they didn't have to grant it. And in fact, if Donald Trump really wanted to do that, he could have gone on Fox. And they didn't want to do it because they want to reach the wider audience that you get with a network. And NBC has a much wider audience because I think they're going to show it concurrently on MSNBC and CNBC as well. So, you know, that's nice for them. Not so nice for the American people who really should be able to see the two candidates separately if they're going to do separate events and not have, you know, flipping back and forth right, or DVRing or whatever they're going to have to do. So I think that's wrong. But I think you're also right, and I hadn't actually thought about this, in a way that really does work for Biden, because Biden probably will get lower ratings. He's just not as exciting. And, you know, Trump is promising to be a screaming, you know, banshee again. He was on CNBC this week, I think, talking to Stuart Varney, saying, yeah, I won the last debate being me, and I'm going to do it again. So it should be, that sort of teasing that he's going to do that. So I'm sure he'll get better ratings. And that's probably good for Biden, because the more people see of that person, I mean, the last one was an absolute dumpster fire of a debate because of Donald Trump's behavior, and it did affect the polls. I mean, it really, between that and the COVID diagnosis, he lost several points, and he has not been able to bounce back, and he's in big trouble because of it. So, you know, okay, you know, pick your poison there. Good for you, Don. I hope you get big ratings.
It was hard to plant a flag there. It was hard to disaggregate there is significant reason to believe that if anything, the COVID thing may have stopped an even greater slide from the last debate. You know, it's very difficult to tell because they were happened so they were almost concurrent. But there, you know, that debate, I think, really did hurt him quite a bit. And I think, I mean, look, the fact that he won't do a remote debate this week and he's going to punt until next week, I think, is indicative of this fact that he realized like he didn't do so great last time. But I mean, be that as it may, let's dispense with some of the campaign stuff up front since we're here. There's two things that are going on. One that is a positive if from the perspective of people who want to see Donald Trump lose. One is that is maybe not so positive. One is that we're seeing national polls and Joe Biden's numbers continue either to maintain, if not grow a little bit. We're seeing something similar in terms of this polling in swing states. And in many respects, more importantly, we're seeing that where Joe Biden has a lead, often it is with 50% of the vote, which is really important, right? Because you never know how those undecideds are going to break. That's on the good side of the ledger. On the not so good side of the ledger, you know, there was a piece by Thomas Edsel in the New York Times this week that suggested new voter registration in some of these swing states. Republicans were outpacing where they were in 2016, and they're outpacing the Democrats. And that is a little bit concerning. New voter registration, generally, they vote that first year because they've just registered. It's right in their forefront of their minds. And, you know, you can poll the voters that you think are going to show up. But if there's new voters that come into the mix, you really don't have an idea of what their propensity to vote is, and you may not catch them in the polls. So we have a very, very tight race, I think, in many respects. I mean, you know, not necessarily in terms of raw votes, but in terms of potential for an electoral win by Trump, not too dissimilarly than 2016. Now, the dynamic is different. There's no doubt between the candidates, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to see an outcome that is similar.
Well, I think we have to be prepared for that because there's only one way, really, that Trump can pull this off with this kind of polling and with, you know, the numbers that we're seeing, and that is if he does exactly what you said. There were a lot of non-college educated white people who did not vote in 2016. And that cohort, that demographic is Trump's only demographic, basically. I mean, he really doesn't have anybody else. That is it. And there are a lot of them, especially in these swing states, especially in the rural areas, all the places where he, you know, theoretically, I mean, he dominates among that particular group. If it is true that they are registering more, and if it is those people that they're registering, I mean, it's possible that Republicans could be registering college-educated white people who would then go and vote for Biden. I don't know. I guess it's theoretically possible, but it's unlikely. These are the people that they're going for. They're people who did not vote last time, who now actually are big Trump supporters, and they're registering them, and they're trying to get them to vote. So, yes, it is something we should think about. And it's in these swing states, in these places with large rural areas where there are a lot of places like Pennsylvania, places like Michigan, places like Wisconsin. And so nobody should be sanguine. I guess that's what I'm saying. That polls look good in a fair and free election in a country that didn't have a stupid electoral college. We could feel fairly confident. But we don't live in that country. Our system is this antediluvian weird thing they came up with to protect the slave states back in the 1700s. So here we are. And I would hope everybody understands that and makes sure that they don't just relax and go, hey, we got this one in the bag. You know, 538 has, you know, Biden up 10 points, so no problem. I mean, everybody has to vote. And by the way, it does appear that Democrats are voting in large numbers. So, you know, fingers crossed that we don't wind up in a situation kind of like we did in 2016, where I think a lot of people just whiffed because they went, eh, you know, who would vote for Donald Trump? Well, we know better now.
Right. I think there's, I think that's true. And I think the Biden campaign, I hope, maybe I'm projecting here, is similarly less confident, I should say, or at least lacking the overconfidence, I think, that the Clinton campaign had. I hope, anyways. So, I mean, you know.
But one final thing. I have been reading that a lot of the groups that came together after 2016, you know, the indivisible type groups, the local groups, all this stuff, they exist outside the party and they exist outside the campaign. And they were really what fueled the 2018 blue wave. And apparently they're still at it. They don't get, you know, it's kind of a disparate sort of group. They're not on the radar of the political press. But from what I have been reading among people who were kind of following that side of what's been going on over the last 4 years, they're very active. So that's good news. I mean, that's and because they're under the radar, it's, you know, it's mostly a bunch of middle-aged women running around getting people, you know,
right. They don't have
people ready to vote. That, you know, that they are actually doing that work that we might think the Biden campaign should be doing or whatever. So, and that's good because it'll last beyond this campaign too.
Right.
And it's nothing to do with Biden.
Well, the interesting dynamic that we're seeing, I think, in many respects is that, and is that, you know, and I think this is the, one of the earlier times we have seen something, one of the few times we've seen this in the modern era, let's say, in terms of Democratic politics, is that we do have these organizations that are functioning without the typical apparatus to let people know that they're functioning.
Right.
And because the reason why we usually get that is that we have these and non-governmental organizations or these activist style organizations whose business model, if you will, and that's a little bit more crass than I mean it to sound, but their model of operation requires, you know, press coverage to allow people to know what they're doing, right? That's the way that they get their funders. They need a certain amount of that to justify, like, you know, the people working at the top of these organizations to justify to their funders and, you know, regardless of who that is. You know, that is just, you know, the nature of sort of like professional activism. And, you know, there's a role for that. I think it's important. I'm not knocking it necessarily. But I do think in some instances it's problematic, right? Because you don't necessarily get the reality as much as you get the reality they want to project, because that is part of maintaining
right.
their project. And usually with the best interests at mind. What you're talking about, these organizations, they exist for one reason and one reason only, and that is to do the politics, the retail politicking. They're not looking for huge, huge funds because they are their own funds.
Right.
And in that instance, it's very hard to know what's going on. Now, to be sure, some of that's also happening on the right. And that is, I think, Trump's unique ability that, let's say, Jeb Bush wouldn't have had. There's no organizing around, like, we're so, you know, frankly, like, you know, there's no Jeb Bush cult, as it were. There is a Trumpish cult that is out there, that is, you know, organizing, and they'll do it stealthily. They have a huge component that's all about racking up the dollars, but they don't necessarily need the political press in the way that some of the left activist organizations do. They have their own press, their own channel, and they have their own agenda. So so much of this is submerged in a way that it hasn't been in the past, I guess is my point.
Absolutely. And there's this whole subterranean right-wing world, too, that is off into the you know, QAnon, and, you know, there's a whole conspiracy thing. This is all, you know, centered on Facebook and, you know, this, that whole side of that world. And that is organizing in its own weird way, right? Because those people, they show up at Trump rallies. They are all, you know, they've got, look at the gear these people yep. wear. I mean, they dress in costumes based Trump wear. It's like a uniform that they have, and they spend money on it, and they do it. So you're absolutely right. I mean, that is another side to this thing. That is something that they, you know, they belong to something. They belong to you can't call it a movement. It is much more a cult of personality, because it's not based in any kind of belief system. It's just we love Trump, basically. But it's powerful. It's obviously powerful. So, well, I don't think we can discount anything, and this is going to be one of those weird elections, and I'm trying not to be pessimistic because
right.
I am optimistic, to be honest, because, you know, you look at the numbers and it really does feel like the country has sort of awakened to the threat, and not just, and, you know, my mission is not, it's not really any more about Trump. I actually don't even care much about him anymore. He's this thing, hopefully we get rid of him. I'm much more concerned about what's happened to the Republican Party. They are very powerful, they're very rich, and they are very, very radical. And they are a movement. They are something that's gone way beyond anything that we've known, and that's not going away. We
yep.
can get rid of Trump, maybe, but those people are still going to be around, and they are a threat. So, you know, we've got to think about that. And I'm already kind of moving on from Trump.
Well.
Not because I don't think he can win, but even if he wins, I don't think that's the essence of our problem. The mm-hmm. essence of our problem is the party that supports him.
Yeah, I think that's true, too. You know, and as we were talking about the sort of those people who gear up and the QAnon, last night I fell into a wormhole where I watched what, by all accounts, in terms of the graphics, you would think is like, it's a local news or it's a cable. I mean, it's not a cable news almost. I mean, and it was a report of a tape of an interview of a guy who was dressed in what appeared to be sort of like a toga, wearing sort of like some type of headpiece. And I'm, you know, I have no problem with people wearing headpieces. I'm just trying to describe the image. Who was a former CIA, a supposedly a former CIA agent, who had direct tapes and audio and video proving that, and I'm going to try and quote because the way they would say it, Obama, Hillary, Brennan, Biden were in on assassinating SEAL Team 6 and paying yep. the Iranians hundreds of millions of dollars to cover it up. The people on the other end of this tape interviewing this guy were saying, like, if we can get you transport to Donald Trump, will you deliver it to the president directly? And he's like, yes, of course I will. And I bring that up because, you know, in any other era, I'd be like, whoa, that's pretty funny. Nobody's ever going to believe that. And in fact, there was a similar thing that was basically whitewashed through the New York Post. I don't know how whitewashed you get in that situation. It's more of like throwing your laundry into something like, you know, like a towel that is like bright red. Things are going to get a little dirty on the other side when it comes out. But nevertheless, and I'm not even that interested in going to that story. People have already debunked it and found that that there was all sorts of discrepancies with that story. But what we should talk about, though, was the reaction by Twitter and I believe Facebook when this New York Post story came out. Now, look, it was laundered by a writer who was a former producer for Sean Hannity, who had like two or three had no past bylines in the New York Post. It was ostensibly emails that had to do. God help us. I wish email was never invented at this point. That were supposedly to Hunter Biden, but they were actually ended up being in PDF forms, and they had been created in a more recent time frame than the cover story for how they showed up would mean anything. And there's a lot of discrepancies. And you know, it's a smear job that, you know, is supposed to be an October surprise. Apparently Rudy Giuliani was involved in some way, and Bannon. I mean, it is what it is. And I don't think it's going to mean much, frankly. But what I do think could actually mean something is more like Twitter's reaction, which was to somehow, you know, prevent anybody from sharing this thing and in many respects, blowing it out of proportion from what it was. And it's interesting, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and we're going to get to Amy Coney Barrett in a bit, but during the break from Thursday's Senate Judiciary hearing on Amy Coney Barrett, Ted Cruz and maybe Josh Hawley, and I think it was Graham. You know, Graham is in for the race of his life, essentially in South Carolina. So he's jumping on board any type of conspiracy theory he can to raise money. They were saying they're going to bring in the CEO, Jack Dorsey of Twitter, to subpoena him and testify to make a big deal about this, you know, like sort of the shadow banning of conservative disinformation and how that is interfering with the election on some level. And I don't know, what's your take on that? Because me personally, if this ends up, you know, bringing in a regime where the social media companies cannot get our data and cannot be so large and are subjected to sort of tighter regulation, I'm for it, frankly.
Yeah, I don't I don't have a problem with that either. I mean, you know, I guess the reasoning behind it matters. But you know, it's inevitable when, and I think weirdly enough, I think these media companies kind of know that this is a big danger and for them, and it's why they've sort of been behaving the way that they have for so long. And now they're sort of cloddishly jumping in a situation like this, you know, 2 weeks before the election, in my view, very foolishly. I mean, look what's happened as a result. It's a stupid story. Yep. If it had been allowed to just sort of go the way that any stupid story would go, there would be debunking and people would talk about, yes, it would circulate. What's going to happen now? They're going to hold hearings, and they're saying next week, and they're going to have, you know, Josh Dorsey and Zuckerberg, they're talking about having him up there too, amplifying the story bigger than it ever would have been if it had just been confined to Twitter. And look, it's going to go through the right-wing ecosystem either way.
Yep.
That these people have their own network.
Yep.
They have their own newspapers. I mean, they can't, you know, Twitter and Facebook can't stop it. Not if they, you know, if it's going to go. So once it's in that, and you know, this was a very smart way to do it, to put it through the New York Post. I mean, obviously, Trump called up Rupert and said, will you do us a favor, though, you know, and let's put this thing out. And, you know, once you get it into the mainstream news, when it's out there, it makes no difference.
Yeah, you're not letting people trade it.
Try and stop it on Twitter or try and stop it on Google or wherever else you're going to try and do it. So this whole thing, I mean, I have no problem with this thing coming to a head because it needs to happen. There needs to be some... You know, look, Facebook and Twitter both, and I use them both, and, you know, they have their upside, and, you know, in fact, I kind of love Twitter in a lot of ways, but they have become pernicious influences in our body politic. They are a problem. The upside is really being, you know, usurped by the downside, mm-hmm. and we have got to deal with this, because otherwise, I mean, we've got half the people in this country living in an alternate universe that's being spread to them by the, you know, through these platforms. And we've got to figure that out because this, forget our current election. I mean, it's our whole culture. Our society is at risk because of this. So I'm with you. If they go into smaller things, look, if they, you know, if Facebook, if that, you know, sharing your grandchildren's, you know, birthday pictures, that's fine. There's a way to do that. But this idea of injecting lies and conspiracy theories into the body politic, you know, kind of trying to plug one hole over here and here and here, isn't going to work. So, you know, this is going to be very interesting to see how this unfolds. And
I know how it's going to unfold
with this one. But it may have actually opened up
an opportunity
discussion in a way that nothing else would have.
Well, I mean, the problem is I know how the first unfolding goes. You know, the first part of it unfolds like this. Every single question asked of Jack Dorsey at this hearing, if it happens, is going to be preceded by a 3-minute rendition of the lying story.
Of course.
And then you're going to get to the, like, how could you block that? Now, we don't know. I'm not talking about the validity of the fact that, Joe Biden has a secret Burisma, printing press of money in his basement of his pizza restaurant. I'm not talking about that. That is, the American public can decide whether, Hunter Biden has actually was actually secretly Barack Obama, and they assassinated the entire, SEAL 16. The American public can decide that. I'm asking you why you didn't let people send that message around. I mean, that's what we're going to hear over and over again. And
it's kind of brilliant. You have to give the wing that's, credit for this one.
Well, let me say this. People should be aware of this technique. You know, every time we see this, we saw it with like the John Ossoff, John Perdue race, right? Or Perdue. I can't remember his first name in Georgia. And I don't know if it's Sonny Perdue. I don't know if it's going to have any implications, but they took one of Ossoff's pictures and they made his nose bigger. And that was, ostensibly because Ossoff is Jewish. And Ossoff complains about it. And then it is mission accomplished. Sonny Perdue believes that it brings value to his campaign for Georgian voters to know that Ossoff is Jewish, is a Jew. And they do one thing, and that becomes, and then Ossoff has to respond, and that becomes the talking point. And then all of a sudden, for 2 or 3 days, the campaign is all about the fact that John Ossoff is Jewish. Now, this is not a problem if John Ossoff is running in maybe other parts of the country, and it may not be a problem in Georgia anymore, but certainly Sonny Perdue thought it might be for Ossoff, and that's why they do that type of thing. I mean, when we see things like, they darkened the skin of somebody in this picture, it is not always, and people should be aware of this, it's not always the first thing that they do that they're looking to get value from. It is the controversy itself actually exactly. ends up serving their ends and their means more in their ends. And it turns out like what they're doing is really a means in which to get that into the bloodstream. So that is what's going on here. And that's why, frankly, I'm not going to sit here and debunk it piece by piece because it just doesn't warrant it. I mean, I'm sorry. If it was real, I would be more concerned about it, frankly. And it's not. And so, but it's going to be interesting. My guess is that Donald Trump is going to be talking about this during his town hall. I got to tell you, and I want to get to the Amy Coney Barrett thing. We're going to. But I saw a clip of Donald Trump at his, I don't know where his rally was this week. I think it might have been in Florida. And he announces
Iowa and Florida, too.
He announces to the audience. He says, finally, he goes, I don't even remember the guy's first name. Robert Orr is gone from the DOJ. And people clap. And he's like, finally, Orr is gone. And so isn't his wife, Mary. And I'm like, I do this professionally. I have no idea who he's talking about. There are people clapping that this guy at the DOJ, I don't know who he is. I've heard Strzok, and I've heard Strzok's lover. But like, this is the closing message of the president of the United States for his reelection, that Robert Orr is no longer at the DOJ. Like, I don't know even what kind of insanity is going on here. And that when you talk about like a second sort of like parallel, realities, that is a very dramatic representation of it. And then he went on to talk about Burisma, but he couldn't pronounce Burisma. He had a lot of energy, and sometimes your mouth, when you have a lot of energy, makes it hard to form words. Now, I will say, I wish, Heather, we could take the energy that Donald Trump has exhibited since his trip to the hospital, and I wish we could bottle that in some way or put it into a pill, because I would like some of that, but
I think it's in a pill, Sam. It's called steroids. And I'm pretty sure he's still taking some.
Yeah.
I mean, his performances this week have been beyond.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. Perhaps I shouldn't spread those kinds of suppositions out in the public, but come on.
I mean, we do know that he was receiving medication from the hospital and that his behavior is consistent with him still being medicated. I think we can say that.
Yeah.
And all right, so let's move from that, unless you have anything to add to this sheer insanity that we're dealing with, to the hearings this week, which were largely a foregone conclusion, because Mitch McConnell is determined to make it his legacy. And we heard from Amy Coney Barrett that she didn't know the five freedoms enumerated in the First Amendment. That's fine. I wouldn't get them either. Of course, I'm not a law professor or being about to be seating on the Supreme Court. I could just name four. I forgot redress and petition like she did as well. We also know that she doesn't really have an opinion on climate change, which is odd for an adult at this point in our society. We also know that she really cannot answer any question about stuff that she has literally publicly signed petitions for, not just petitions, paid advertisements in major newspapers. I think she did a very good job of basically ignoring every question that was asked of her, but doing so in a nice way.
Well, she's an extreme right wing, jurist. I mean, she is a real extremist, and I think she goes beyond her mentor, Antonin Scalia, who had some vestiges, a thin vein of libertarianism that ran through him that sometimes would, suggest maybe that, government power should be curtailed on civil liberties, for instance. There would be times when he would rule in that way. She is Clarence Thomas. Essentially, Amy Coney Barrett is going to be, there's going to be a new block on the court with her and Thomas holding down this extreme right wing end of it. I watched these pretty closely, and I was really, really astonished that this is where they've come. And not because I didn't see it coming, or I don't know what the Federalist Society is about, or I didn't, I'm uninformed on how far right these people are. Now, it's not because she said anything. It's the fact that she, and there were a number of issues. We all know how she's a very religious person, and she sort of grew up in a what they call a charismatic Catholic, kind of cult-like sort of group, and she lived there, all the way through college. I mean, she is very much a part of a very right-wing religious
My understanding is that
system.
She met her husband while they were both living at the compound house of the leader of this group, and
right.
that's how they became married.
That's right. It is a very, very, whatever it is not what you'd call a mainstream Catholic belief system. It just isn't. It's a fringe belief system. And because of that, her beliefs on things like, abortion and birth control, health care, all those kinds of things are going to obviously be informed by that. There's no question about it. They can keep asking her about it. She's not going to answer, but we already know that. What we didn't know before this, and this is what really astonished me, was, they asked her questions like, do you think a president must commit to a peaceful transfer of power? And she said she couldn't answer that question. It was nice that we had always had a peaceful transfer of power. It's one of the nice things about our history. That's all she said. They asked her whether or not the president can single-handedly delay an election. She couldn't do it. She wouldn't commit to recusal on cases about this upcoming election, even though the conflict of interest is obvious, since the president who appointed her said he wants her on the court in order to decide the election, which he said he expects is going to happen. This is, this is really crazy stuff. I mean, this is stuff where we're seeing an assault on really our basic fundamental belief in how elections and how our political system actually works, our democratic system works. And she would refuse to do it because she said these are contentious issues and that she can't, you know, take a position. They're not contentious issues, right. Or at least they weren't. That right. is not the case. There has never been, ever been any kind of contentious sort of argument about whether or not there should be a peaceful transfer of power. Now, it's true that Donald Trump is saying that now, but he really, I mean, in this case, you know, I'm all about, you know, the Republican Party being responsible and everything. This is Donald Trump's thing. He's the first one to do this, and now we're seeing the Republican Party fall in line behind him, and we have a Supreme Court justice, you know, nominee here who is basically, you know, kind of going along with it. I mean, there's no other way. Right. There was nothing. There was no problem in her saying, of course, I agree that there should be a peaceful transfer of power. Yeah, who doesn't think that, right? There was no reason for her not to say that. And yet she didn't say it because she knows what her job is on this court. Now, I don't know whether the election will go to the Supreme Court. I don't know what's going to happen there. But the fact that we're putting people on the court now who are that political
yeah.
and who are that obviously partisan, yeah, that she couldn't even just come out and say something as anodyne as, you know, yes, well, you know, the president can't single-handedly delay an election. You know, that's in the Constitution. I mean, that is just obvious. So, you know, this is very scary to me. This is not business as usual. And obviously the Democrats had very little power to do anything. It's another example of how we are now in a political era of raw power,
yeah.
which to me, and I wrote about this in Salon this past week, you know, to me, this is just says everything about what Democrats have to do. I am, you know, I'm not a particularly radical person in many ways, but they can no longer ignore the fact that they must use their power under the Constitution to right this balance. If they don't, we're sunk.
We're sunk.
These are the kind of people who are going to be running this country from the courts, from the minority. If the Democrats don't take the steps, get rid of the filibuster, expand the court, you know, attempt a D.C. statehood, those kinds of things. If they have the power to do it, they absolutely have to use it. And by the way, this is what the Republicans are saying every single day. Look, we had the power to put those people on the court. You would
right.
do the same thing.
Exactly.
Okay?
Now you now you do the same thing. Yes. And just and I don't mean to restate any of your points, but to just add to that, just to point out that notion that you're saying that, look, the way things get normalized is they go from settled to controversial to settled in the other end. And so when she says, I'm not going to get involved into certain controversies or policies that of things like, you know, whether climate change is real or things like that, what you're saying is that you're bringing them from the realm of this is what we all understood to be the case, that there's a peaceful transfer of power, into an area where it's like, you know, differing people can have differing ideas on this, and that means that there is no one right answer. That's highly problematic, particularly in a form of government that has been so heavily reliant in the sort of like the blank spaces, right, in terms of our charter.
Right.
Of our government, right? Like, you know, a lot of these things aren't covered. But I will say this, Sheldon Whitehouse said this morning at the final day of the hearing, which seems like a lifetime ago now, that don't come whining to us.
Yeah.
We can say now that you guys are breaking the rules, but it's going to be, once they're broken, they're broken. Don't come whining to us and say, like, you know, that Republicans don't need to follow rules, but Democrats do. I'm glad to hear that from Sheldon Whitehouse, but I'm not going to feel so comfortable about it until I hear it from Chris Coons or that I hear it from, you know, his ilk, frankly, because my biggest concern is this is the Democrats are going to do what they have done so many times in the past, which is like, you guys shouldn't have done that. That was wrong. But whatever, you know, like that
two
type of
thing. Two wrongs don't make a right.
Exactly.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah, well,
no, sorry.
Two wrongs
no.
actually can bring some balance to a situation. Exactly. One right and one wrong and repeated wrongs end up sinking a government, like you say. So, Heather, we will reconvene in a week or so. We are now approximately 2.5 weeks out from what we traditionally have called Election Day. That will be the final day of voting. It may not be the resolution of the election. It more than likely will not be. And the only thing, you know, I think it's incumbent upon, and I think you share this sentiment, people need to go out and vote. And if you can vote early and you can do it in person, by all means, vote early and do it in person. Very, very, very important to do at this point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Don't rest on your laurels. Not this time. We can't, because we don't know what's going to happen. It's crazy time.
Heather, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
New analysis from government watchdog Accountable U.S. looked back at publicly traded companies that took SBA Paycheck Protection Program, also known as the PPP loans. Found that at least five companies spent or had planned to spend roughly $5.9 million on dividends or stock buybacks after receiving their PPP money. Here to discuss, Lizzie Price from Accountable.us. So this week, Lizzie, we are in the midst of, I guess in the midst or maybe in the midst or some form of negotiations between Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin. On one hand, the White House has a $1.8 trillion bill that they want in terms of coronavirus relief. The House has a $2.2 trillion bill. It's not just a question, obviously, of how much. It's where it goes. And Mitch McConnell plans to bring to a vote a plan to basically repurpose, as far as I understand, repurpose money left over in the PPP, which was the Paycheck Protection Program. I think there was something like, a couple hundred million dollars left in there, and repurpose that money to basically run it again. You guys have AccountableUS.us have basically begun to dig into what happened to the first two, I guess, tranches of the PPP. And the findings are a little bit disturbing in terms of where it went. And it also sort of explains maybe why there was some money left over, because, well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's go through what you guys found, because one of the complaints of the original CARES Act was, and probably why the Republicans did not return, was because it gave all this money to corporations via the Treasury and the Fed and really didn't do much for people and not very much for small business. Just walk us through what the Paycheck Protection Program at first was supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Paycheck Protection Program was set up to ultimately help small businesses weather this storm of the global pandemic that we have not seen in anyone's lifetime. And it ultimately was supposed to help workers and small businesses survive. And what we have seen through, we've been studying this ever since we got information from the federal government back in the spring about this program. What we have found is that it's primarily gone to the wealthy and well-connected. It's gone to big businesses. It's gone to public corporations. And we have lost so many small businesses as a result. And that is due to a lot of different problems. It was the actual program was designed poorly. It was badly implemented. There were not accountability sort of standards put in place. So now actually what we're seeing too is that there are a lot of instances of fraud that we're seeing. Millions went to businesses that didn't exist or businesses that inflated their employee counts, and the administration failed to keep that in check. And so what you have is you have these businesses that got millions in funds and ultimately bought a Lamborghini or a yacht. And that money is taxpayer money that should have gone to small businesses that kept people employed, and those businesses, kept those businesses to stay in business while we sort of weather this never-ending storm.
So, all right. So Let's talk about the process in which, I mean, one of the problems was that we have no mechanism in which to do this, right? I mean, unlike other countries who were well-positioned to deal with this crisis, we don't have a mechanism to provide people, all people in the country, money if they need it. We don't have a mechanism in which to support small businesses. And so let's talk about the mechanism that had to be jerry-rigged. And it, you know, on one hand, I'm sympathetic that there, look, we have no structure for this. On the other hand, when we created the structure, it revealed some real problems with inequality, I think, in access to, I don't know how to really express this, to banking relief and banking services that exist within our economy that I'm not sure that was so clear before.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What we found too, when in several of our research reports, is that this money went primarily to businesses that sort of already had an advantage. So it really left out businesses owned by people of color, by women, and that's obviously a really big problem too. And one of the reasons why that happened is because we went through the banks. So there was this lack of accountability from the federal government. They supposedly were keeping up with information about how many jobs, you know, each loan would go to save and all of these stuff. And what we found by the actual data that we've gotten back from the government is that those numbers are just completely pie in the sky made up. And so there's no accountability on sort of the information that we're getting when we're giving away these huge loans. And one of the problems with the way this is set up and the systems that are set up to do this, the banks here were incentivized to provide loans as quickly as possible. And most of those, you know, that happened with banks that already had these relationships set up with these large corporations. So if a business didn't have sort of that relationship with one of these banks that was lending, they were put at the bottom of the pile, basically, when it came to actually getting these loans. So there's so many things that go into this. That was primarily, those businesses were owned by people of color. They were smaller businesses. And so there's so many parts of the system that broke down that favored these large corporations over these small businesses.
That to me is fascinating, because it reveals, I mean, it is so revealing about how there is, and I don't know if you call this systemic racism and systemic misogyny in our society, or if you call it, it's certainly, you know, sort of like, as far as the results that come out of it, it is at the very least, you know, systemic disparity. And it is, you know, because if we know that women-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses had the toughest time accessing this, we now know that they also have the least amount of relationships with banks. And this is, I mean, that is just, I mean, I guess on some level, I'm not surprised by it, to see it, that how naked it is, and then the implications. Yeah. And I mean, this means that, and I think, your report, and I think where you just stated, we've lost over 100,000 small businesses in this country. And so when there's extra money, like, what does it mean that there's extra money that was there? And by extra money, I mean leftover money, because if we've lost 110,000 businesses, how do you reconcile the fact that there was still money left in this program?
Well, I think that you can kind of read between the lines here. I mean, it's because those businesses are no longer applying for those loans because they're no longer in business. And that's the big problem, if they had put together a program from the start that had these sort of enforceable transparency and accountability, then we maybe we'd be holding on to a few more of these businesses that actually, you know, are no longer in existence. And I think that it's just, and it when you see one of our other reports showed that that there were several businesses that got millions of money in this Paycheck Protection Program, and they used it for corporate buybacks.
Right.
They used it to pay dividends. So stake, you know, their stockholders, their executives really got a boost. They enriched themselves through the taxpayer dollar. And that's what's really horrifying, particularly when you look at how many families are struggling right now,
right?
How many people are out of work, how many small businesses are just gone. And you know, you've got these people at the top that are just getting richer and richer, and you've got everybody else struggling to get, you know, to get groceries in their refrigerator every week.
Yeah. And I want to get into the results that you found in that report, but I don't mean to sort of get hung up on this one question, but it seems to me there's two scenarios, right? One scenario is that these 110,000 businesses, it's probably higher by now, that have gone out of business, they did so because the Paycheck Protection Program was not sufficient. It was limited for essentially an 8 to 10 week period. You needed to, you know, any money that you were going to get forgiven as basically a grant must have been spent within that 8 to 10 week period on payroll primarily. I think there was a little bit that you could expend on rent. Well, this has gone on for obviously since March. I mean, so 8 weeks is not going to be sufficient. The other scenario is that there were tens of thousands of people who simply the banks did not have enough of a relationship with them, didn't care about their application, and they just rejected it first off, you know, because the banks themselves only had a certain amount of quotas that they were going to fulfill. And you needed to, you know, have a relationship with four different banks. Otherwise, you're 10th in line, and they're only giving out 9 or 8 loans or something. I mean, that seems to me to also have been working there. And so the combination of those two scenarios, and I imagine it's both, right? I mean, it's probably it wasn't sufficient. And in other words, there was absolutely no access, indicate that we have this sort of dramatic problem that the government didn't seem to care about. And then we have this other problem that your report underlines, is that the controls on this money were seemingly completely absent, or at the very least insufficient. And I imagine on some level it's because who is in charge of making sure that the companies that got the money met their obligations to get the money to turn from a loan to a grant? Like, who was responsible for that?
Well, it should have been through the SBA, which is under the Treasury. So I will say one thing that, you know, before we sort of put all the blame on the banks, I do think that that one issue that you saw at the beginning of this program is that the money ran out really fast. And the reason there is, you know, banks didn't actually have that much information, because
right,
the SBA and the Treasury did not give them that information. There weren't clearly outlined here, you know, here is how you do this, here is how you prioritize, you know, to make sure that this money gets to communities of color, that this money, you know, touches small businesses and you know, rural areas. And so because of that lack of communication from the federal government, the banks sort of did what they could do as fast as they could. And they did profit off of it. So they're not totally,
right,
not totally
right
off the hook. But that was also a really big problem, because everybody was just kind of scrambling, and it was just this sort of chaos that you saw from, you know, sort of beginning to end. And now you're seeing it with the negotiations, because they keep going back and forth. And, you know, we're on with the negotiation now, and then we're off 2 days later, and then we're on again. So, you know, it's kind of hard to keep up, and it just feels very messy. And it really has caused a lot of problems for our economy.
Is there a difference between the two tranches, right? I mean, there was the first round of PPP, and then they came back for a second bite at the apple. I don't know how many weeks later it was. I can't, time is all completely collapsed for me. But I think it was like maybe a month later, maybe 6 weeks. They came back for another bite at that apple, ostensibly. I believe the Democrats and really, frankly, Nancy Pelosi, because the Democrats at that time weren't even caucusing, as far as I know. They were just the basically up or down vote on what the speaker had essentially determined was going to be the ask. I think they were asking like north of $300 billion for the PPP. And was it 300 billion or million at this point? And like I say, a bunch of that was never even tapped. Did that money go out better in that round than the first round? Because supposedly it was targeted to make sure that people who were left out of the first round were scooped up in the second round. But for all we know, they could have been out of business at that point. Do you have any data on that? Do you have any sense of it?
So that's a really great point. So we actually don't have a sense of that because we have only received a little bit of information from the SBA. And we know that the data that they gave us, some of it was just completely made up, just completely fictional. I think the Trump administration gave some comically large number of jobs that they claimed to have saved through this program. That just didn't happen. I think part of it is those businesses could have absolutely gone out of business by then. But also part of it is we actually have no idea. And that's a really big problem because this taxpayer money, this billions of taxpayer money, and we don't know where it's going. And that's where you get the things like, you know, you get a quote small business owner that buys himself a Lamborghini in Florida. Or, you know, someone who buys a million dollar DC row house. And so that's where you get all this fraud, because if we don't have the information, we can't assure that that's not happening. They're now going back, they're saying they're going back and sort of looking at all loans over a certain amount of money.
Mm.
But there's a lot of smaller loans too that aren't being looked at, and there's just this door is wide open for fraud here, and there's just no accountability at all.
Well, how do we know? Like when you guys did this report, how do we know about this guy with the Lamborghini?
That is a great question. We know from media reports because the federal government actually sued these people. They figured it out. We just didn't know about it because they have the information and we don't. So they're not sharing that information. I think, they obviously, the Justice Department has this information somehow, but they're not sharing it with the rest of us.
So we don't know how they know. So, I mean, is it conceivable that there are checks on this money and that, if we know about that element of fraud, what makes you feel like we don't know about other elements of fraud? I mean, to the extent that there were any.
So, I mean, you know, let me put myself in a president's shoes real quick. That's not a job that I want, but
I understand.
We'll just do that for a second. If I'm putting together this program and I am seeing, I have this information in front of me and I know that this information exists, why wouldn't I want to share it with people? I mean, is it there's so much fraud that they're worried about sharing that information, or is it just they don't have it in a format that's easily produced? I don't know. we don't know. And that's, I think that's the worrisome thing, because you don't want to sit here and like think, okay, are they doing this? Are they doing that? Are they doing that? You don't want to sit there and do that, because if you're the government, you want to be very clear and transparent about what you're doing,
right,
so that you don't have people like me going on speculating about what you're doing, because it's very clear from the start.
Well, it is, you know, I think we have so many problems with all of this, the way this bailout happened, and not the least of which it was the distribution of enormous amounts of money to corporations, much less so to small business. And we have a completely dysfunctional method in which to support small businesses. And you would think it would be better based upon the amount of time we hear politicians talk about small businesses being the, I don't know, the heart of the country or the driver of our economy or the source of all jobs, et cetera, et cetera. You would think that a country that at least rhetorically pays such lip service to the small business, that we would actually have a mechanism in which to protect them in situations like this. But it appears not. Lizzie Price from Accountable.us, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Lizzie Price is Director of Strategic Partnerships at Accountable.us, where she manages partner relationships in progressive media. That's it for another week of Ring of Fire Radio. Thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers last week that decided to help our show by becoming supporters. And if you're listening to our free podcast, become a member of the show. Support the program. You can do so over at ROFpodcast.com. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
Oh, hats and on toes, coats and in sleeping bags. I come to know that memories were the best things you ever had. The summer shorn, beat down on bony back. So far from home where the ocean stood, down dust and pine.